Thanks. I'm very excited to be here to tell you what I've been doing over the past few years. My name is Gabriele. I'm a finishing graduate student at the University of Arizona working with Vasilis Paskalidis in the space of numerical relativity. I study strongly gravitating and dynamical systems like accretion onto binary black holes. And here at the bottom right, we can see a snapshot from one of my simulations. And the topic of today's discussion, charged black holes. Before I get into that, I want to acknowledge the support of funding agencies that made this research possible, particularly NASA and the Texas Advanced Center for Computing that gave me fellowships over the past few years. I want to start reminding you one of the most important theorems in general relativity. This is the Noether theorem. The Noether theorem states that if you have a single isolated asymptotically flat black hole, you only need three numbers to describe it. And it's its mass, angular momentum, and charge. And that's it. Over the past century, we've studied isolated black holes extensively, and we've studied them in their full expressions as objects with mass, angular momentum, and charge. And I'd say that nowadays, we have a pretty good understanding of how single isolated black holes behave. However, the same cannot be said about binary black holes. I'd say that the nonlinear interaction between black holes with charge is a largely unexplored territory. And I'm going to use the first part of this talk today to tell you why I think that there's a lot of interest in science that can be done in this space. Right now, we don't know about orbits, emission, details of the interaction. If you place two black holes with charge and you place them close one to the other, we don't know what happens. But I think this is a very interesting space to explore. But before I get into that, I want to make two quick points. First, I'm going to use units in which the gravitational constant, the speed of light, and the permittivity of vacuum, they're all set to one. In these units, I can measure charge and mass in the same way. And this highlights how the real parameter I'm interested in here is not charge or mass. What I'm interested in is the charge to mass ratio. And to give you a reference, if you're not familiar with these units, especially in the electromagnetic side, the charge mass ratio for a proton is a very, very large number. It's order of 10 to the 18. And this, in many ways, is a statement that electromagnetism is much, much stronger than gravity. And using these units highlights that, again, I don't really care about what is the specific mass that I'm studying. So I have the scale freedom and results, for the most part, I'm going to apply to stellar mass black holes, supermassive black holes, and even microscopic black holes. Second, I want to emphasize that when I say charge, I don't necessarily mean electromagnetic charge. Yes, to first approximation, we can think of charge as our usual electromagnetic charge, like this charge to mass ratio of a proton. But as I'm going to discuss in just a minute, charge is an umbrella term that encompasses multiple theories that are not our usual boring electromagnetic charge. With that out of the way, let me tell you why I'm so excited to be in the space of dynamical systems with charged black holes. First, one of the main applications is in the context of gravitational wave astronomy. We are in the era of gravitational waves, and gravitational waves open new windows in the universe that have not been possible before. So we can place new classes of constraints that have not been possible before. We can look at regions of the parameter space and constrain them in a way, again, that is not possible in other ways. But if we want to take advantage of gravitational wave observatories, for instance, to constrain charge of astrophysical black holes, then we must have a pretty good understanding of binary black holes and quasi-circling spirals of binary black holes with charge. Right now, LIGO, Virgo, they are completely blind to charge. They cannot see that, they cannot constrain it. But if we want to take advantage of these instruments, then we need to improve our understanding of, again, the nonlinear interaction between charged black holes. And I'm going to spend a good fraction of my talk today discussing this specific aspect. And again, when I say charge, I don't necessarily mean electromagnetic charge. There's theories that I put under the umbrella of exotic astrophysical theories that will predict some form of charge. This can be primordial black holes. This can be magnetic charge. This can be dark matter. You can have some form of dark charge. There's even dark matter with this called mini charge, which is a Q over M much, much smaller than the proton. All these theories, which are still allowed in specific regions of the parameter space, can be constrained using gravitational waves. And if we want to constrain these theories, if we want to rule them out and place new constraints that are not possible with other methods, we need to have a better understanding of black holes with charge behave in the nonlinear strong field regime. And again, gravitational waves offer a way to peek into the strongly gravitating and dynamical regime of gravity. So we can probe the theory of gravity itself. And Not only specific modified theories of gravity in specific limits reduce identically to essentially black holes with charge, but also charged black holes are a well-defined way to study an example of modification of gravity so that we can consider biases in our instruments, degeneracies, and improve our pipelines to constrain the theory of gravity with a well-defined, precise way to go beyond what we traditionally do with vacuum relativity. And also, other modified theories of gravity, while not reducing specifically to charged black holes, are essentially, we can study them starting from charged black holes. And I'm thinking about scalarization in Einstein Maxwell scale for the expert in the audience. And we don't have to stay in the realm of gravitational wave astronomy. One of the main reason why I'm so excited about charged black holes is that because we can use them to push our understanding of our theories to the extreme. And so in many ways, we can go back to what people did in the previous century of using charged black holes as a way to probe the fundamental interactions like gravity, electromagnetism, and you know, strong and weak gravity. So we can use charged black holes to perform controlled experiments to push our theories to the limits and test conjectures and ideas. And for instance, we can consider the interplay between extreme electromagnetic field, extreme gravitational fields, and even extreme kinetic energy in this ultra-relativistic collision. So I see charged black holes as a great place where we can perform controlled numerical experiments to push our theories to the limits and see conjectures and test them in regimes that are not accessible otherwise. And finally, again, shifting target once again, we can study the production of microscopic black holes and from energetic particles like cosmic rays or particle accelerators. There's theories that will predict some form of production of microscopic black holes like the TeV gravity. And most particles have charge. So if you want to properly study and constrain these theories, then it's best if we have a improved understanding of how black holes with charge in these nonlinear settings behave. So for all these reasons, I think charged black holes are a very interesting place where to look at. And there's a lot of interest in science that can be done here. And what sits beneath all these scientific goals is the way I'm going to attack the problem. That is going to the fundamental equations that describe charged black holes. And these are Einstein-Maxwell's equations. Einstein's equations, they describe gravity. Maxwell's equations to describe electromagnetic-like fields. And when we put them together, we have electromagnetic fields and on a curved background with a back reaction of the magnetic fields on the background itself.
In the context that you're thinking, how would you keep a black hole charge? I mean, are you going to think that somehow nature in some order is asymmetric so as to...
Yes. That's a good point. I'm going to discuss the charge of black hole in 1 minute. But here, there's no matter. There's just electromagnetic and gravitational fields. There's no issue with discharge because in this theory, in which I don't include anything else, black holes don't discharge because there's no other particles. So if I just take this zero order approach in focusing on the gravitational and electromagnetic field, charge is conserved. But I'm going to discuss discharge. In 2 slides, or no, maybe 5 slides. So if I may defer the answer to later, you can ask me more if you're not satisfied. So here my approach is going to the fundamental equations, Einstein-Maxwell's equations. And for the system I'm interested in, well, in this case, I want to study binary black holes. I want to study black holes with approximately nearly equal mass and with significant amount of charges. So there's no symmetries I can exploit. There's no perturbation theory that I can apply. And Einstein-Maxwell's equations in this case are a strongly nonlinear, strongly coupled system of partial differential equations. So this is all to say, I'm not going to try solving this problem analytically. I'm going to solve the problem numerically. So I'm going to use numerical relativity. And what I'm going to do specifically is I'm going to break the beautiful description, covariant space-time description that we have, and I'm going to restore an idea of a time evolution from some initial data, so in a 3+1 decomposition type of scheme. And historically, already in the case of pure Einstein's equations, this has been very difficult. This is a difficult problem to solve. There were issues with stability, gauge, initial data, singularities. took a long time to be able to perform this type of simulations in pure Einstein's equations. So I would say that numerical relativity, this, the field that essentially grew out of the efforts of solving Einstein's equations for non-trivial systems, is a field that it's itself in its infancy. There's still lots of room for improvement. There's still lots of regions of the parameter space that we'd like to explore, but we cannot. So while I'm pushing and trying to explore the system of Einstein-Maxwell's equations, I'm also contributing towards improving the field of numerical relativity itself, developing new techniques and tools that, again, while I'm applying them for Einstein-Maxwell, in many cases they can be applied across the board. So this is one of my points of view, is try to advance numerical relativity itself as a field. And for today, what I decided I'm going to tell you is, first, I'm going to tell you a little bit about some of these advancements in numerical relativity that enable the first fully self-consistent, long-term stable simulations of quasi-circular mergers of black holes with charge in full Einstein-Maxwell theory. And second, I'm going to cherry-pick one specific application that is constrained on astrophysical black hole charge using gravitational waves. And there's lots that I didn't include in the talk today. So please reach out to me at the end of this talk if you want to discuss other aspects or us in more detail about the specific ideas that I maybe just touched upon. So let's start with numerical relativity. Some of the work that was needed to perform simulations of quasi-circular mergers of charged black holes in a fully self-consistent way. These are some of the advancements that we introduced. One of the most important missing piece was the initial data. Initial data for numerical relativity is not a simple problem. It requires the solutions of elliptic partial differential equations. So what we did was we extended previous formalism based on the so-called Bowen-York formalism for initial data to accommodate for charge. We extended a code, and now we can generate initial data for pretty much arbitrary systems of two black holes with charge and momenta and spin. But once we have the initial data, that's not the end of the story. We have to understand what's inside in our initial data. We have to understand the physics and the properties of our black holes. So for that, for the first time, we implemented the full expression of the quasi-isolated formalism put forth by Abhayash Dekar in Einstein-Maxwell, and so that we can have a well-defined notion of what's the mass, charge, and angular momentum of our horizons. And interestingly, when you include the Maxwell part to this formalism, you get contributions to mass and angular momentum from electromagnetic fields, which is not something that you have in the vacuum case. So once we have the initial data, once we know what we have in our initial data in terms of physical properties of our horizons, then we can start our simulations and we can perform our simulations. And what we found is what all the half a century of work on numerical relativity found. We found issues with stabilities and other problems in numerical relativity. So one of the critical ingredients that was necessary to enable this type of long-term simulation was the development of a new technique, or the extension of a technique to control high frequency numerical noise that arises from our grid, that we call continuous dissipation. It's called continuous because throughout our grid, that it typically has multiple resolution, it's a mesh refined grid, this introduces a continuous differential operator as opposed to other discontinuous techniques that were used previously in the literature. And this was proven, this was needed to perform this type of simulation, otherwise we will get numerical instabilities. And finally, we have our initial data, we have our evolution, we have to understand what's in our evolution. What type of signals, what type of emission we get out of that. So for that, we have the full, we implemented fully the Newman-Perrot formalisms in Maxwell and Einstein and Maxwell case so that we can get a notion of how much energy, how much linear angular momentum are lost due to not only gravitational waves, but also electromagnetic waves, because in this case, they are important. So with all of these, then we can perform and understand simulations of long-term and fully self-consistent simulations of, say, quasi-circular mergers of charged black holes. And just to tell you a little bit about our computational stack, we work in the framework of the Einstein Toolkit, and this work would have not been possible without the Einstein Toolkit. The Einstein Toolkit is an open source suite of codes for numerical relativity, and we use a mix of well-established codes for instance, the lean code for evolution that has been around for more than a decade, plus some of our new codes like this two-charge puncture, which is an evolution or an extension of the below of the two puncture that was widely used in our community. And I also want to mention that I also develop a completely new post-processing library called Qubit. And if you ever happen to use Einstein Toolkit, I highly recommend checking Qubit out because it will make your life much easier. And Qubit became the first and only post-processing library included in the Einstein Toolkit. So I think it has a very large impact specifically on new users on how to get the most out of Einstein Toolkit simulations. But if these words mean nothing to you, let me translate into a more computational physicist point of view. The type of simulations that we perform are simulations on Cartesian grids that are adaptively mesh refined. So we have our two black holes and our grids have multiple resolutions and they track our black holes. The type of equations that we solve are for the most part, they're mostly nonlinear and they're either elliptic or hyperbolic. And we solve them and they're all partial differential equations. And we solve them with a mix of methods from pseudospectral solvers for our elliptic equations to very traditional methods also of the line finite differencing schemes for our evolution. Most diagnostics are going to depend on integrals, mostly volume or surface integrals that we compute using interpolations. And the type of code that we're talking about is a very traditional high performance computing code where it's mostly C, C++, and Fortran. And we have a shared memory parallelism with OpenMP and distributed memory parallelism with MPI. And again, this is a very traditional high performance computing type of code. We don't even have support for GPUs as it stands right now. And the cost of each of these simulations is typically a few weeks, months, depending on your configuration and resolution. So it's not as expensive as my accretion into binary black hole simulations, but it's still quite expensive type of calculation to perform where we solve the directly Einstein Maxwell's equations. So this is our computational setting. So now I'm going to dive into the specific application that I decided to tell you about today, that is constraining the charge of astrophysical black holes with gravitational waves. And for that, I'm going to tell you why we think that black holes should be neutral in the first place. So what's the main argument for why charge has not been considered so far? And the fundamental argument looks like this. Let's assume that you have a black hole with charge. Let's assume that it's positive for the sake of argument. And let's assume that we have a proton that is floating nearby. Well, we're going to have accretion of this proton onto our black hole if and only if the sum of the forces, electrostatic and gravitational, on this proton are such that we have a net force towards our horizon. And we can plug Newton's law and Coulomb's law to get this expression that I have here at the bottom, that we have accretion of the proton onto the black hole if and only if the charge to mass ratio for our black hole is smaller than the inverse of the charge to mass ratio for our proton. And if you remember, I said that the charge to mass ratio for a proton is a very, very, very large number. So this means that we have accretion if and only if the charge to mass ratio for our black hole is very, 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 very small, smaller than 10 to the minus 18. So let's flip this argument around. Let's assume that we have a black hole that is born or somehow acquires some charge that is larger than 10 to the minus 18, this number. Well, then what happens is that we're going to have accretion of particles of the opposite sign, because we can always do that. Forces are always pointing towards the horizon. But we're not going to have accretion of particles of the same sign. So we're going to have discharge. And while this is a very, very simple argument, it doesn't take into consideration timescales. It doesn't take into consideration the fact that this is not how accretion happens. Accretion happens through an accretion disk. This is why we consider astrophysical black holes to be neutral. And this is a compelling argument, but I ask myself, do we have observational evidence that this is indeed the case, that the charge should be neutral? And what the main argument I could find in the literature uses properties of accretion disks. So let me go through this argument. If we have charge in our central body, well, charge is going to severely affect the structure of the accretion disk around the central body. And this specific study I'm quoting here specifically looks at the charge for Sagittarius A star, the black hole at the center of our galaxy. And if you have charge in your Sagittarius A star, you're going to change the structure. And what we see on the left is how essentially how the almost the inner edge of the disk changes depending on your charge configuration. And if you change the disk structure, you're going to change the thermodynamic properties. You're going to change, in turn, this changes the emission properties. So if you can model out the emission, then you can reverse engineer the process and constrain the charge of CGC-RSA star. However, the type of modeling required here is very difficult. This is a very difficult problem to do. The Event Horizon Telescope taught us that to understand the accretion flow around CGC-RSA star is a lot of effort. And also this type of constraint depends on, critically depends on the object I'm considering. The accretion flow for CGC-RSA star is going to be very different from the accretion flow from M87. So I feel that we can do better. I feel that we can place other type of constraint, again, I'm going to use gravitational waves. And the reason I'm so interested in is because suppose I gave you compelling evidence that there was charge or some charge in Sagittarius star. Well, that will severely challenge our understanding of black hole formation and environments. So I think it's important if we have the chance to indeed constrain the charge to mass ratio, not just use a theoretical argument, but use observationally backed arguments. So use our data to indeed confirm that charge is zero. And this is even more important when you once again blur what charge is. There is ways to go around this constraint that charge to mass ratio has to be zero, smaller than 10 to the minus 18. Many of these fall into this exotic astrophysical umbrella that I mentioned before, like dark matter theories, which we have maybe a charge to mass ratio for the fundamental particle is very small. We have a dark photon with dark coupling. So we have some form of like dark charge. And we can have magnetic monopoles. We can even have modified theory of gravity, like this scalar tensor vector gravity that I mentioned here, that essentially predicts that gravitating bodies have some form of, like, let's call it gravitational charge. And the charge to mass ratio depends on the coupling of this theory alpha. So if we can constrain these theories, I think it's a good thing to do to constrain these theories and or flipping things around. If we found that we had some charge to mass ratio in our black holes, that will probably point to one of these theories. So with gravitational waves, what we're going to do is we're going to try to place constraints and rule these theories out. And specifically the idea is, well, if we have charge, then we have some form of like electromagnetic energy and electromagnetic, again, can be dark electromagnetic energy. In relativity, energy mass, they're the same. So we're going to have some, we're going to change the space and curvature. We're going to affect this orbital dynamics. And that will leave some imprint in the gravitational wave. So we can get our constraint on charge directly from gravitational waves, as opposed to going through the process of modeling out the accretion flow for astrophysical black holes. And I think this approach of using gravitational waves has at least two big strengths. The first is that, as opposed to thinking about emission mechanisms, there's not much modeling involved here. Gravitational waves don't interact with the environment. They are emitted, they are detected. We don't have to think about the microphysics. It's relatively light in modeling. And I'm also solving Einstein-Maxwell's equations, which to some extent we consider fundamental equations that describe nature. And second, in this approach is more directly applicable to those exotic astrophysical theories that I mentioned before, as opposed to, once again, looking at emission properties. Because once again, I'm solving directly the equations that describe those theories. So here I'm showing an example of my simulations of mergers, quasi-circular mergers of charged black holes on the left and black holes without charge on the right. And what we can see at the bottom is the gravitational wave emission for these two systems, where I lined up the emission and merger, because that's what we detect. We don't know when the merger started. And as we can see from here, the signals are different. And that's beautiful. That's what we want. We want different signals so that we can constrain the charge. However, this is my simulation. There's no instrumental noise. I have perfect knowledge of everything here. This is not what real gravitational waves look like. This, on the top left, is what real gravitational waves look like. What we have here is GW150914. This was the first confirmed gravitational wave event. Still today, it's after 90 plus detections, it's one of the loudest and best characterized events. And as you can imagine, the amount of efforts that went into understanding the signal. This was a nearly equal mass ratio in spiral. a merger, so mass ratio of 29 over 36. And there was also a coincident and disputed electromagnetic wave observation. And I'm going to make a note about that in a second. But first, when we have this real actual signal, what we would like to do is we'd like to take this data, perform full Bayesian analysis, and find what's our posterior for the charge and say, okay, the data tells us the charge is within this and this with this confidence level. This is what we would like to do. This is what we do for all the other parameters. But this is not something that we can do right now. And we cannot do it exactly because we don't have a good understanding of the nonlinear action between charged black holes. We don't have good gravitational wave models for black holes with charge and merger. So in order to be able to place a definite constraint with using full Bayesian analysis, we need to improve our models. And that's something I'm interested in working. So instead of doing full Bayesian analysis, we're going to do what we call mismatch analysis. And but first, the note about electromagnetic wave observation. My simulations have electromagnetic waves. I don't know if you can see, but here we have a beautiful spiral pattern in the electric field, the arrows here and the electric field. And this spiral pattern is electromagnetic waves. We have electromagnetic waves in the same spirit that we have gravitational waves. But the problem with electromagnetic waves is, one, is that the frequency of these waves is very low. It's so low that it's below the plasma frequency, the expected plasma frequency for the interstellar medium around GW15 or 914. So these waves are not just going to free stream to us like gravitational waves do. These waves are going to interact with the environment. And somehow this energy is going to be reprocessed. And this is not a simple problem. Understand the interaction between electromagnetic wave, interaction and propagation of electromagnetic waves from the source to our detectors is a difficult problem that requires modeling. And I don't want to do that. Also because I don't want to be focused on electromagnetic waves and charge. I want to trade, if you want, like better constraints with wider constraints, in the sense that I want to constrain also those exotic astrophysical theories that I mentioned before, the dark charge and so on. And for those theories, there's no electromagnetic emission, or there's nothing that we will detect naively with our telescopes like we did for the disputed electromagnetic observation. So here I'm ignoring the existence of this signal and I'm purely focusing on gravitational wave, on the gravitational wave data. Also, because I want to be able to perform this analysis, not just for GW15 or 914, but for all the other 90 plus detections that we had. So with that, let me tell you how we use gravitational waves to place a constraint on the charge. So what we did is this, we perform an array of simulations with charge. And for each simulation, we extract gravitational waves and we ask, okay, let's take this simulation and let's compare it with our reference GW15 or 914 using the instrumental noise that we had at the time of GW15 or 914 that I have here on the right. For this simulation, I'm going to ask, how much signal to noise do I need to distinguish these two signals? And if I marginalize over some unknowns and I find that I don't need too much signal to noise to constrain that, then I can say, okay, well, if the signal to noise ratio to distinguish the two signals is small, then we will have had enough signal to noise ratio. This is not compatible with the data. And in this way, I can scan values of charge and find what is the maximum charge that is still compatible with GW15 or 914 with the signal to noise ratio of detection of GW15 or 914, which was around this 25 value. And what we found is this. We found the first constraint on black hole charge from fully self-consistent numerical relativity simulations of charged black holes in Einstein Maxwell. And we find that the charge mass ratio has to be smaller than 0.2, 0.4, where the different values depend on your choice for the relative charges between the two black holes, like same charge, opposite charge, or just one of the two black holes charge. And 0.2, 0.4 is not much, especially if you think that the maximum charge mass ratio allowed for a relativistic black hole is one. So this is about 20 or 40% of the maximum allowed charge for a black hole, which is a significant number, especially thinking that the theoretical argument suggests 10 to the minus 18. And if you think about electromagnetic charge specifically, then you can also translate this constraint into a constraint into the charge imbalance, that is the difference between the mass of positive particle and negative particle in GW15 or 914, or flipped around. And this constraint will translate into a constraint on the charge imbalance of 10 to the minus 17 solar masses, which put in this way seems an awesome constraint. From this constraint, we can also translate, for instance, into the so far tightest and only constraint in on scalar vector sense of gravity in the strong field, where we constrained its coupling alpha to be smaller than 0.19, where alpha equals zero is general relativity. And before, the previous strongest constraint was alpha smaller than 9 in the weak field. So this is an improvement of order of 2 orders of magnitude approximately. And shortly after our paper, a different group led by Gregorio Carullo used a different technique for gravitational wave analysis and found pretty much the same constraints. They found here what we can see is the Poissonian distribution for their final charge mass ratio for a series of events, including GW15 and I14, which is this blue line. And what we see is that their constraint is the final charge mass ratio should be smaller than approximately 0.4 or 0.3. So we essentially agree on the level of constraint we can place on GW15 or I14. And what you see here is essentially the state of the art in constraining black hole charge with gravitational wave observation. So the level of constraint that we can place right now is 0.2, 0.3, 0.4. So I asked myself, what about the future? What type of constraints are we going to place in the future? And I'm going to spend the next 10 minutes or so of my talk discussing future plans. But first, I want to emphasize that now that we have, for the first time, a full nonlinear solution of the equations, we can do stuff that we couldn't do before. We can look at properties that were not accessible before because we didn't have such solutions. For instance, we can study the mass charge and angular momentum of the remnant and look at their modes of oscillations, like quasi-normal modes, and learn if we can place constraints from that, for instance. Or we can look at the interaction between the recoils due to emission of gravitational wave or electromagnetic waves as kicks. But also something I find quite useful is that now that we have full solutions, we can go back to the approximate methods and the approximate solutions and benchmark them and understand where those approximations worked and where we can use them, where they're reliable for what type of studies we can use them. So in this way, we can, for the first time, understand the extent of which some approximations that were used in the literature hold or not, and where they can be used or not. So now I'm going to have an eye to the future in many ways. First of all, the future of us as a community, in the sense that we're going to have amazing detectors soon. We're going to have
Sorry, before you go on, do you mind if I ask a question?
Yeah, please.
So one question I have is, so I would suspect that what makes the signal, the gravitational wave signal from a charged black hole system different from a neutral black hole system mostly would be about dipole electromagnetic radiation emitted by the system. And so what I'm wondering is whether you tested that. I mean, is this too simple?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And indeed, that's the case when you have, especially when you have opposite charges. So if we go back to my simulation here, in this case, I had a plus minus charge. That is, I had a strong dipole emission here. And we can see when I line up my signals, a merger, most of the difference indeed comes from the spiral. So when I have opposite charge in my system, then the most constraining part of this type of constraint comes from the inspiral, where the dipole emission is much stronger than everything else. But when I go towards merger, as you can see, the waveforms are identical. So it really depends on what you can do, the mass range that you can detect. We had detections in which we only see the very last cycles. And those cycles don't have much information, because for the opposite charge case, most of the constraint comes indeed from the fact that you have dipole emission. But there's also the case in which we have same charge. If you have two black holes that have the same charge, then the dipole emission is going to be very, very, very small. And the next leading order, the quadrupole emission, is, you know, behaves pretty much like a gravitational wave quadrupole emission. So there is a strong degeneracy between charge and mass, specifically in the case where you have same charge. So the question is, indeed, this is a good point, but if you consider
the same charge, you really mean the same value for the charge or the same mass to charge ratio?
Well, if you have same charge to mass ratio, then it's going to be zero dipole emission or very close to zero. But when you have smaller differences in in the two charges, the dipole emission is going to be much smaller and is not going to be contribute as much. So in general, this is true, but it's true for the in-spiral. It's not true for the merger phase. And it's true mostly when you have a large difference in charges. It's not as pronounced when you have same charge.
Yeah. So yeah. So I would certainly agree with that. I mean, so that in turn suggests to me that in order to do that mismatch analysis, I mean, it probably would be very sufficient to formulate a very simple model for for the charge system, right? I mean, you just add the dipole, modulation to the phase, and that should be good enough to do your estimation.
We can already do something like that, like a post-Einsteinian expansion is something like that, in which we add essentially a dipole emission that is parameterized. But the real question is, this is not what LIGO observed. The LIGO observed the last few cycles. So it really depends on your mass scale, how much signal you have access to. So if you don't have access to the early in spiral, then the only place where you can place the constraint is in where you have signal. So that is the nonlinear phase. And the nonlinear phase is where we need to solve everything. So I do agree with you that, for instance, for LISA, where LISA is going to observe long in spirals, then this is not needed. We don't need to go through these efforts. We can focus on the dipole emission. That's going to be enough. But for LIGO and for ground-based detectors, where we are going to observe with high signal-to-noise ratio, but mostly we're going to observe the mergers, because that's where we have our, the mass scale, that's where we need this type of studies. But I do agree with you.
Gabriel, I have a question, a related question on that. So I still, at some point, I want to go back to your arguments of why you would consider charge, but be that as it may. So if you are entertaining, like in this case, general relativity with a given charge to mass ratio, so if you can imagine a black hole that is charged, then the very same process that gave rise to the black hole is giving rise to a neutron star. So then the neutron star would be charged. And neutron stars are seen at lower masses, and then the same effect would play out. So I would say, if you're going to argue that black holes will be charged, why can you not argue equally that neutron stars will be charged, and then you'll have plenty of cycles there?
Yeah, no, I've never thought about that. I will have to think a little bit more about that. That's a good point. I think the neutron star case is not as clean in terms of modeling. So if I were to include charge in neutron stars, one could always argue that it's a difference in equation of state, or it's a difference in anything else. So I think there's much more degeneracy due to an unknown physics in the neutron star case as opposed to black holes. That's my first attempt.
Sorry, I would disagree there. So again, if you're thinking about the spiral, the equation state comes with a tidal effect. But if you're charging it, okay, now you have a dipole. So in the spiral regime, you still have this same behavior. And the equation state is a nuisance that will not play a role if you're very late in the merger.
Yes. I think so. I mean, yes. If we focus on the in spirals, early in spirals, yes, I think I agree. But yeah, I never thought, I should think a little bit more careful about charge before about neutral stars, before making any comment. But thanks for bringing this up. I never thought about that. Any more questions or comments? Okay, so maybe
I had a quick comment or question. Sorry. You may have mentioned this at the beginning. I could have missed it. But do these in these simulations, will the black holes develop a walled charge?
What is chargier? Charge is essentially chargier is a boundary condition, if you want, or charge is the existence of some specific configurations in our electromagnetic fields. So I don't necessarily locate charge. I mean, I know charge is is in my horizon, in the sense that I can compute some integrals that tell me the charge is in my horizon, but I cannot really say that there's a wall of charge or anything like that. It's many, many ways, this is boundary conditions.
Okay.
Okay. So maybe I can look at the future and I can tell you about our future detectors. So what I'm showing this plot is, so on the x-axis, I have a few future detectors, as well as Advanced LIGO, our current detector, at design sensitivity. So we have Advanced LIGO, A+, Voyager, Einstein Telescope, and Cosmic Explorer. And on the y-axis, I'm asking the question, okay, what if we had GW15 or 914, but we had also those detectors working at design sensitivity? How much signal-to-noise ratio do we need to place a constraint at level better of like Q over M smaller than 0.3 or 0.1, 0.2, 0.1? And as we can see here, first of all, is that it doesn't really matter too much what detector you have. More specifically, what matters is the noise distribution across frequencies. So the Cosmic Explorer does a little bit better. But also, it gets more difficult, of course, to constrain charge. The smaller the charge you have, you're closer to vacuum, as we would expect. And the scaling is roughly quadratically. So it gets quadratically more difficult to constrain the charge, depending on how much charge you have. That is, you need quadratically more signal-to-noise ratio to constrain better the charge. The good news is future detectors are going to have signal-to-noise much larger than 30, that is my bound here. So all these constraints that I have on this plot right now, they're going to be easy. Like any future detector is going for pretty much any signal that we have, we detect early spiral, we detect the merger, we detect quasi normal modes, we're going to place these constraints, which is good news. And even LISA, the LISA interferometer space antenna, is going to place constraints at this level pretty much anywhere in the universe that it sees black holes. And this, to me, is particularly interesting because we can scan across multiple redshifts. And if you're interested in those exotic astrophysical theories, maybe with dark matter, this is something that you might be interested in. And this was the good news. But the bad news is that if we want to do better, and we want to do better, then we need to significantly set up or improve our modeling game. We significantly have to improve our simulation and post-processing analysis in charge black holes, but also not charge black holes. So I'm going to use the last few minutes to tell you more about that. So first, I'm going to give you a primer on gravitational wave detection. That is, when I say before that GW15 or 914, that was the signal that we detected, that was not really true. This is the actual data that I downloaded from the LIGO website. This is GW15 or 914. And as we can see, we cannot see GW15 or 914 here. There's pure noise. And for gravitational wave detectors, right now we are completely dominated by noise. This is to say that we really have to have a good understanding of our expected signals to be able to tease them out. So indeed, what we do is we take our numerical relativity calibrated models, we compare with our signals, we found where there's agreement, and then we go back, we clean the data, we see GW15 or 914. So this is, again, is a roundabout way to say it's really, really critical for detection, but also for parameter estimation, for an analysis, to have very good understanding of these signals. And in the future, this is going to be even worse. In the future, when we're going to have our LISA, our Einstein Telescope, and our Cosmic Explorer, even our vacuum generativity waveform are not going to be good enough. We really need to understand all the wiggles in our waveforms to perform good constraints and to extract parameters well from our signals. And in this, I think Einstein Maxwell can play a role. One way I'm developing, again, numerical relativity and gravitational wave astronomy, but also I think it's important to go beyond the beaten path, go beyond what we're currently doing with vacuum GR, to understand a little bit better what we can say about biases, degeneracies in our pipelines. So in this, while I'm developing Einstein-Maxwell and developing the tooling around Einstein-Maxwell to place constraints on charge of astrophysical black holes, I'm also developing tools and techniques that can be used in general across gravitational wave astronomy to place better constraints. And more specifically, what I'm thinking is maybe in the future, there will be new unmodeled effects that we want to take into consideration. This can be modified theories of gravity. This can be environmental effects that maybe contribute to the gravitational wave signals in our black holes. And most likely, we're going to perform numerical relativity with that simulations. We're going to get some waveforms out of that. We're going to build models that can be used for gravitational wave astronomy. And then we place constraints. So this is a pipeline to go from some form of like understanding of our physics to constraining that physics. And in this, this pipeline that I'm building for Einstein-Maxwell, I feel especially the links are not necessarily tied to Einstein-Maxwell itself. So while I'm building formalisms and tools to do this for Einstein-Maxwell, I'm also building useful formalism and tools that can be applied, for instance, when I'm going to think about Einstein-Maxwell scalar, when I'm thinking about any environmental effects, for instance, the development of like surrogate models or using catalogs or building catalogs for simulations, which is not necessarily trivial. So this is something I'm very interested in pursuing over the next years, in going beyond just numerical relativity simulations, but making sure that these simulations can be particularly useful for gravitational wave astronomy, constraining charge, but also constraining all these other effects. And there is a second line of research in this numerical relativity with charged black holes that I'm particularly interested in, that I haven't had the chance to talk today, that I would like to continue exploring over the next years, that is using charged black holes as a way to perform numerical and theoretical experiments or to understand more about theories. And for that, I'm just going to give you a quick idea of what I mean with this. One of the studies I performed is thinking about ultra-relativistic collisions of charged black holes. That is, I take two black holes, I give them charge, and I smash them one against the other very, very fast. And so this, again, is a way to have a system that has extreme gravitational field, extreme electromagnetic field, extreme kinetic energy. So all these systems have few parameters. There's not much that I can tune except initial velocity, initial separation, this type of stuff. But from here, I can really, really push our theories in corners of the parameter space that are not accessible in any other way. So I think this is a really good place where we can understand more about our theories. And here, for instance, I thought about implications for cosmic censorship or maximum luminosity of physical processes, this type of studies. And I think the Einstein-Maxwell is a really, really excellent place. It's well posed, and it works quite well. So this is another line that I'm very interested in continuing over the next years. And with that, I'm going to sum up the presentation today. So I told you about some of the advancements in numerical relativity that enable the first fully self-consistent quasi-circular mergers and other type of simulations and Einstein-Maxwell charged black holes. Then I told you about some astrophysical applications, and that is the first numerical relativity waveforms and the constraints that we found on charge mass ratio for black holes using this type of data with GW15R14, and also look at the future a little bit, what type of constraints and what we need to do to reach to improve our own constraints. And I also told you about an example of a bound that is on this scalar vector tensor gravity. As I tried to say, I think this is a very exciting space. I think there's a lot of interesting stuff that can be done here. On one side, thinking more about astrophysical applications, like gravitational wave astronomy, mostly, again, not necessarily with charge, but as a field itself and as a model effects themselves. I'm currently working with collaborators on that, and I'm also working on trying to understand a little bit more about the role of like plasma around black holes, and that is starting to go towards, okay, how we can retain charge if there's any charge, or what happens if electromagnetic waves cannot free stream. So for instance, in this project, we're currently carry on with Vitor Cardoso, Raimon Luna, and Miguel Ziyao. We're understanding the effects of trapping energy around the black holes to see if that leads some imprints in our gravitational waves. And also we have, I'm currently working on more theoretical, if you want, inclined projects, like understanding going beyond the head-on collision with some hyperbolic encounters with fine-tuned zoom wear effects, or citing cosmic censorship in quasi-circular mergers. And finally, again, I'm personally very interested in building useful gravitational wave pipelines for gravitational wave astronomy with Einstein-Maxwell simulations. So with that, once again, I'm going to acknowledge the support of NASA, the Texas Event Center for Computing, the support over the past few years. And I'm very happy to continue this discussion and take any question you might have. Or comment, please.
Hey, that's awesome, Gabriel.
Yeah, thank you, Gabriel. So let me go back, and so I have a question, so maybe a comment. So with respect to, so I share your wholeheartedly your sentiment. Okay, you have a new way to look at systems, might as well just look. But if we're going to be considering charged black holes, I mean, it's not enough to say, I think, so one could take the position, it's not enough to say, well, measures of charge of black hole are not very conclusive, etc. But if we are going to argue black holes are charged, then we have to argue that somehow, whatever they were formed, there was an excessive charge of some given sign, and this is why they retain it. And in their nature, they haven't been able to create anything from the other chart, from the other side to kind of neutralize themselves. So I think by the fact we have plenty of evidence that on large scales, large-ish scales, the universe is rather neutral. So it's hard to argue that it's yes, natural. Yes. But okay, so that's the comment. So that's why I don't think it...
Yeah, yes, I absolutely agree. And if you ask me, do I believe that black holes are charged? I'm going to tell you, no, I don't think black holes should be charged. I think we have very good reasons to consider black holes should be neutral, exactly for the reason that you say is, if we have charge, we will have to explain also formation. And that's, collapsing objects typically don't retain much charge, for instance. I absolutely agree with that. And my other comment is, yes, That's true for electromagnetic charge, but for instance, what about dark photons? I don't know very much about dark photons or magnetic charge.
I would agree with you there, but again, you would have to argue this, the nature somehow made it such that there is an asymmetry, because you would also have this, the other side that you're trying to shield it away. But it doesn't matter. I mean, this is just an academic discussion. So I just wanted to ask you, what do you mean by continuous dissipation? I mean, the standard receiver operators are continuous.
Yeah, continue. So what do you think about that? Yes, so continuous dissipation, let me explain that a little bit more, because indeed we found it was a really critical component for stability. So let me first define dissipation in my terms and the type of simulations that I perform. Again, the type of simulations I perform are grid-based simulations. So we have Cartesian grids, but the local resolution changes depending on where we are on the grid. We have a high resolution near the black holes because we want to resolve stronger gradients, and we have lower resolution near the outer boundary because there's nothing interesting there. So these are mesh-refined simulations. And the traditional dissipation would also, in this context that many people call Kreis-Eiliger-Eiliger dissipation, introduces an operator that essentially dissipate, it's like a high order parabolic type of this operator that dissipates high frequency modes essentially. That's essentially some artificial viscosity. Traditionally in this part of literature with this type of like simulation, what I've seen is that the strength of the dissipation, this artificial viscosity was chosen or is chosen routinely to be uniform across the grid. So it doesn't matter if you're in the high resolution region or in the low resolution region. So effectively what you're doing is you're introducing discontinuity in your equations because the dissipation, the effective dissipation changes every time you cross a refinement level. So if you, okay, in theory, we should add zero, this shouldn't matter in the limit of continuum. But in practice, what we find is that the traditional what we could call maybe discontinuous dissipation that doesn't take into consideration these jumps was, for some reason that we still haven't fully explored, was introducing some numerical amplification of some errors that will lead to this very fast exponential growth in our constraints. The continuous dissipation on the other side takes a lot of care in ensuring that the actual dissipation that we have across the grid is the same. So the actual differential operator that we have is continuous, as opposed to having the jump essentially into a coefficient, if you want, of the viscosity. For some reason, this just works better. Maybe I can add that this seems to be a particular property for this Einstein-Maxwell's equations. If you go on traditional Einstein's equations, the discontinuous dissipation works perfectly well. There's no issue, but this having continuous dissipation seems to be a very critical ingredient for at least this type of simulation at this stage with our current understanding of how things work.
Gabriele, may I ask you technical questions?
Yep.
This is Eric Schnecker. Are you using buffer zones?
I'm using what, sorry?
Buffer zones. It's a technical term when you use mesh refinement with carpet.
Can you hear the word?
Buffer zone.
Buffer zones. Yes, I'm using buffer zones, yes.
Okay, and the other question, what about refinement in time? Do you refine in time?
Yes, we use refinement in time, and the choice for refinement time is so we are partially using refinement time, so in the sense that many levels on our simulation are synced up, so they are not refined, and the choice for that depends on stability conditions, because we have
near
a few equations.
Near the outer boundary, I assume.
Yeah, mostly under our boundary, yes. So the equations,
okay, yes. Like
the evolution of the shift, but also the way we control the Gauss constraint needs proper care in the maximum time step. So we are very careful with time refinements.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I don't understand why the regular dissipation would not work for you.
Yeah, we spent quite some time thinking about this, and I mean, we can discuss more. There are other issues with outer boundary instabilities that I can touch upon, but this works.
Any other questions?
Yeah. So maybe a question, just kind of following up on the previous ones about the most promising systems to look for charge. So, I was a bit curious why you focus so much on GW150914 or like binaries and that mass ratio, just given that, like as mentioned before, if you have dipole radiation, you expect that to show up at low frequencies, and even if you disregard neutron stars, I would think that you could get stronger constraints just with lower mass binary black holes. Mm-hmm. So did you consider other observed binary black holes and whether that
So that's a very good point. And indeed, as soon as we found that that was the case, that the early spiral constrains more, and I have quantitative definition, like results on what it means to constrain better and worse. For instance, if we look at the merger phase here, it's impossible to distinguish these signals from merger. So we have a very good way to say, yeah, the spiral matters. So the obvious idea is, okay, let's go beyond GW150914 and let's go towards lower mass mergers where we have longer signal in band. The problem with that is that there's a competition between how much signal to noise ratio we have and how much signal we have in band. So GW150914 seems to be a very a good balance between we have very good signal to noise and we also have some decent cycles in spiral. When you go to GW 15, 12, 26 alpha, the Boxing Day event, I think, was that it's much lower mass, that the signal to noise drops. And in many ways, this constraint is almost a statement on how much signal to noise ratio we have. So as it stands right now, I think, as Gregorio showed us, I think the best we can do is actually with GW 150914. But I'm very much interested in expanding this to other events. But I think the way to do that is not to continue with this mismatch analysis, because it will be wasteful to just run like specific simulations for each single event. So that's why I'm trying to build this longer term pipeline where I can use models, surrogate models, using like a training set of simulations to be able to go towards no one, no 100, but the thousands of events that we're going to have in years. So I hope this answers the question.
So in that analysis they have on the right, did they consider both the case where the charges are opposite for the black holes?
Same charge. This is because there's an important difference. If you have opposite charge, then you can have that you have a cancellation of charge. So the remnant is neutral. In their analysis, they use a lot of information from the quasi-normal modes. And if you have a neutral remnant, then it's a little bit more difficult to make claims. So in their case, they focus only on the same charge case. So the two black holes have same charge. And I also want to, maybe it's a good point to mention that when we think about the exotic astrophysical theories that I mentioned before, the most relevant case is the same charge case, because in many cases, you only have magnetic monopoles, you have one charge of one type of magnetic monopole, if I remember well. Well, at least in some of those theories, like you have only one psi, so you get you don't get the opposite charge case.
Okay, thanks.
Any other questions?
If not, let's thank you for your again.
Thank you very much for all your comments and questions.